The Guardian.
The Guardian has partnered with audible.co.uk to offer listeners a free audiobook when you sign up for a one-month, no-commitment trial of the Audible service. Audible has over 50,000 audiobook titles available to download. Go to guardian.co.uk/audible for further details.
Hello, this is Science Weekly. I'm Alok Jha. As the winter winds blow hard and most of you are, hopefully, snug and warm at home, surrounded by family and friends, what better time to think about the South Pole? Shift your thoughts to an explorer, a titan amongst men. A titan who raced to the bottom of the Earth. Though he lost out, his name is still remembered with reverence. That man is Captain Robert Falcon Scott. This edition of Science Weekly is dedicated to him, his team of explorers, and to the scientific research that they carried out. Scientific research that no one had done before, never mind in such harsh conditions. In this show, you'll hear from Edward Larson, whose book, The Empire of Ice, explores the scientific triumphs nestled amongst the tragedies of Scott's Terra Nova expedition. He talks of the corrosive competition Scott had with the Norwegian explorer Roald Amundsen for the title of first man to reach the South Pole. I also dropped in on the preparations for a celebration of Scott's work, due to open in early 2012 at the Natural History Museum in London. Scott's last expedition celebrates the 100th anniversary of Scott's fatal adventure to Antarctica. So, put on your sealskins, sharpen your ice picks, and join me on this cold, cold journey into the life and science of the explorer Robert Falcon Scott.
Amundsen gave a modest account that avoided direct contrast with Scott. He offered due credit to his sled dogs. Curzon was not so discreet. In introducing Amundsen, he spoke more warmly of Scott, who, he said, whose footprints reached the same pole, doubtless only a few weeks later than Amundsen, and who with perseverance and the true spirit of scientific devotion is gathering in, during the absence of 3 years, a harvest of scientific spoils, which when he returns will be found to render his expedition the most notable of modern times. In his closing remarks following the banquet, Curzon added, "I almost wish that in our tribute of admiration we could include those wonderful, good-tempered, fascinating dogs, the true friends of man, without whom Captain Amundsen would never have got to the pole." Then, as Amundsen remembered it, Curzon concluded with the phrase, "I therefore propose 3 cheers for the dogs," and turned to look toward the Norwegians.
Edward Larson, welcome to Science Weekly. Thank you very much for reading that excerpt out. Now, there's something interesting about the bit of the chapter you've just read from your book, Empire of Ice. Amundsen was the one who won the race to the South Pole. He is in the story books, he is the one who is the sort of hero. Robert Falcon Scott is kind of a failed man in some respects. Why was the head of the Royal Geographical Society, why was he trying to humiliate Amundsen?
There'd been a bad relationship between Amundsen and the British all along, because Amundsen had bested them, and this wasn't the first time. The British had always claimed that Franklin and his failed effort, where he also died, as Scott did, had been the first to complete the Northwest Passage. But, of course, Franklin never did it. It was Amundsen, 80 years after Franklin, that was the first to actually make it through the Northwest Passage in a remarkable 3-year trip. Now he had taken on Scott. Scott had pioneered the route south, and Shackleton had carried it forward. And so the British government and the British people had gotten behind Scott to have another expedition, and Amundsen had taken an expedition that was originally geared to the North Pole, but then when Peary had allegedly made it to the North Pole so that Amundsen wouldn't be first, he turned on a dime without telling anyone except his brother and went south instead, took his expedition south, and beat the British to get to the South Pole. So that had created this animosity that Amundsen had basically, with a very small party, in a small boat without great resources, had beaten these massive British efforts. And to help justify that, to help explain it, The British had always said that they weren't about racing to the pole. They were about doing science. And so Curzon, when he was welcoming Amundsen and acknowledging him, he said, but Scott is still down there. Of course, at this time, they didn't know Scott had died. They thought he had gotten to the pole and gotten back, but just had not gotten out that year because there was no radio. There were no communications. Once you were down on the ice, as it were, once you were down in Antarctica, you were out of contact. And so they wouldn't be able to contact Scott until he came back a year later, because you can only come back in the summertime, the Antarctic summer. And so they had envisioned that Scott was spending all this time leading this scientific expedition, and their ultimate justification, the reason why he said this would be the greatest expedition of all time, Scott had said the same thing. Even after he knew Amundsen was going to beat them, he said, we can still have the greatest expedition if we do a proper scientific expedition and not a mere dash to the pole.
So Scott's fate as an explorer was very much tied to the scientists and scientific ambitions of his team. And this is all part of a growing movement by Edward Larson and others, if not to rehabilitate Scott's reputation, at least to rethink how we view his expedition and its legacy. One way to better understand what Scott was doing is to see the many artifacts and samples that were collected by his Terra Nova expedition. Many of these things are being gathered for an exhibition at the Natural History Museum in London. I went along to watch the whole thing being put together.
My name is Ellen Simonson. I work here at the Natural History Museum in the exhibitions team, and I've been the lead developer for Scott's last expedition. So Scott had already been to Antarctica once, and he was the leader of an Antarctic expedition about 10 years earlier. He went the second time. We now know it as a discovery expedition. And ever since he came back, I think he had thoughts about going back to Antarctica again and then finishing some of the work he'd started. So he tried to get to the South Pole, but didn't get there. So he wanted to make sure he reached the South Pole and was the first person to do it. He also wanted to continue his scientific program. To do that, he recruited a quite big team of scientists to go with him. At this time, scientific expeditions to Antarctica were not new in any way, and they'd been going since the 19th century. But what was different from during Scott's last expedition is that it was the biggest scientific program at that time, and the work they did was sort of broader than any other expedition before them.
So what kinds of things did he want to do?
So he worked with his scientists. This is not just about Scott, it's also about the other people who went with him, so the scientists, but also the men in the offices who went with him. And he was working with the scientists to look at meteorology, continuity studies, zoology, but also they did groundbreaking work in glaciology, which was really a new discipline at the time, just to mention a few areas.
And so, fast forward nearly 100 years, all of the equipment that and collections and samples have been distributed in various places around the world. Where do they sit, and how does your exhibition sort of bring them together?
So historical items from the expedition sit all over the place. Canterbury Museum in Christchurch in New Zealand has a large collection, Christchurch being a sort of the last port before you leave for Antarctica. And we have a large collection of scientific specimens that they collected. So this is really the first time in 100 years that we're reuniting original items that they used when they were there with the scientific specimens that they collected.
When you say historical items, what do you mean by that?
I mean things like skis, clothing, the food they ate, microscopes they used. We have letters, diaries, a range of things that they used when they were there.
Scott's expedition was equipped a bit like a modern-day mission into space. His team of scientists included zoologist Edward Wilson, the meteorologist George Simpson, physicist Charles Wright, and geologists Frank Debenham and Raymond Priestley. Scott was already a seasoned polar explorer by the time he began his Terra Nova expedition. With a brilliant team and kitted up to his insulated ears, why then did things go wrong?
Scott made mistakes. Scott made poor choices. Amundsen, if your goal was getting to the pole, Amundsen did it right, and Scott did not do it right. But with Scott, it was part of a larger effort. And when you focus on the race to the pole, you miss much of what the British expeditions were about, including some of the best stories. And to understand that, you have to realize that the Terra Nova expedition, the one that Scott was on at the same time as Amundsen, was not the only British expedition. There had been a series of three British expeditions, beginning with Scott's Discovery expedition, led by Scott in 1901, which was funded by the British government and sponsored by the Royal Society and the Royal Geographic Society. And even though Scott, from the very beginning, wanted to get to the pole, at that time they didn't even know there was a continent in Antarctica. They thought it might be an ice cap like in the north, anchored on islands. He took a team of scientists, and publicly it was described as purely a scientific expedition. Now, Scott was not a scientist. Scott was a captain in the Navy. Once he got down there, once they had their base situated, once they were encamped for the winter, as it were, and for the summer in between, they ended up staying two winters and therefore parts of one whole year and parts of two others. They had a team of scientists, different scientists, were going to fan out, doing a variety of work that had been an agenda worked out by the Royal Society and the Royal Geographic Society. Scott was really free, wasn't needed to do science. And so on the side, he was going to go south. Shackleton was his assistant. Bill Wilson, they were heading to the South Pole. They didn't get anywhere close to the South Pole on that expedition. Shackleton comes back on his own expedition. He takes a team of scientists. The scientists are off doing their research, and he tries to go to the pole. And then in the third expedition, the Terra Nova expedition, the one on which Scott died, the scientists did their work. It was a well-planned expedition. They went to the right places. They did their work right, where Scott then was off going to the South Pole. He had planned the expedition well. He had even planned the trip to the South Pole well, but a combination of poor choices during the execution and bad luck led to his failure.
So Ellen, where are we now?
We're in the Gerwood Gallery in the museum. It's one of our temporary exhibition spaces at the moment. It's empty. We're painting the walls to suit the Scott exhibition, and we have a load of crates from Canterbury Museum with a Canterbury Museum artifact in it. And this is where Scott's last expedition will open on the 20th of January.
So I can see nine large sort of wooden crates, each very carefully sealed up. Can we open one of them up?
Of course. Let's have a look.
We're just taking the lid off one of these crates. I wonder what we're going to find underneath. There's a couple of layers of foam. So far it's just foam. Hopefully they've not just sent you a box of foam.
Let's hope so. What you see here is a number of items related to food and eating, and I think we have also some post stamps. So I think we could take something up and look at it.
So what? This is something for letters and that kind of thing.
So the interesting thing is that they had their own post office that the New Zealand government had issued. So they had their own post stamps, and Scott was postmaster. But of course, the post only arrives once a year with a ship coming back, and only leaves once a year. So those letters that they got when the ship came back to them were, of course, eagerly awaited. We also have a ceramic jug, and you can see here with the Terra Nova expedition emblem, which was designed by the chief of scientific staff, Edward Wilson. It's really nice with... you can see the bottom of the Earth with a penguin standing on the South Pole. And it says British Antarctic Expedition, Terra Nova. It's really quite a beautiful thing.
And this would be a milk jug or something?
Yeah, it's a ceramic milk jug.
It looks like something that would sit quite nicely in a very nice, stately home. It's not something you'd expect, sort of sitting in the middle of the freezing cold in the Antarctic. How did they live in their huts?
Well, when they were in the hut, actually, it was relatively comfortable, and they had china and metal forks, and it was basically what you would expect on a ship, for example. And they also had more rustic ware, like enamel wares, and they sort of used them combined, really. But in terms of the what they were eating quite well, and every day their cook, Clissold, would cook them a three-course meal, and often they had penguin or seal meat, and he used to make different stews and disguise, but they had this meat so often that they, you know, they blessed his cooking, because they got lots of different varieties of seal and penguin meat. But you also have surprising items like jams, cheeses, tinned vegetables, like we have a tinned asparagus. Let's go over here and see if I can take it up. So it's quite a long, thin tin, well packed. Here we have asparagus tin. It's now empty. It's really quite beautiful, nice and blue with a really nice label on it. Back
in the crate. In the exhibition itself, how are you going to display all of these sorts of objects? I mean, is there going to be a journey from being in the hut to going out onto the sledge? I mean, or are they going to sit behind pieces of glass?
They'll be displayed in cases. And the journey of the exhibition, really, visitors take the journey of in the beginning, of the ship itself. So you kind of, you go through Scott Planning's expedition and them getting to Antarctica, looking at some of the things and some of the scientific items they collected on the way. And then you walk into this quite amazing space, which is a representation of the base camp hut. So it's the same size, and within it, we tell the stories of everyday life and activity around the hut. So from what they ate, to what they did in their spare time, to where they slept, but also the scientific work that they did in and around the hut. And then when you leave this sort of safe space of their home, really, their home in the winter, and 25 men stayed in this relatively small hut during the first winter. And then in the exhibition, you leave this hut area, and then you start exploring the kind of work they did outside, so different scientific work that they did, but of course that includes the pole journey too, where we will show scientific specimens, but also scientific notebooks alongside sledges and clothing and skis and different kind of cookers they had with them. So it's really a really nice mixture of everyday items that are used with the scientific specimens and the scientific work they did.
So it was a scientific mission in all terms of funding and officialdom in London. But Scott was an explorer first, and he wanted to get to the pole.
Yes, Scott was not a scientist. He wanted the glory of getting to the pole. He was an adventurer. He wasn't originally interested in Antarctica, but he it was a peacetime navy. This was a path for ambition, for his moving forward, for doing something unique. He gets picked for this job, and by the third expedition, by his Terra Nova, his main personal goal was to get to the pole, and he was upfront about it. But to justify it, if you're at Oxford or Cambridge, and your goal is to win honors in chemistry, but on the side you also want to win the cricket match, and getting to the pole was sort of bagging the pole became something important to the British public, that not only can we do good science, but we can also get to a place that nowhere else, nobody had been before. And so Scott mounts that, and that was just a series of mistakes and failures that led to his demise. But meanwhile, his team of scientists, who had a very ambitious research agenda, working in many areas, they were making profound discoveries that transformed our understanding of global ecology, of the environment, of the history of the globe in biology. Tremendous discoveries.
So take us through some of those, actually. I mean, let's talk about the successes of those missions. And what were your favorite scientific achievements of those missions?
Well, there were a series of goals. They were mapped out for the first expedition, and they were followed for all three. And so it was sort of like a moon mission. When they do one of these lunar missions, all the scientists in different fields all try to get their experiments on board. And that's what happened with the Discovery expedition and the Terra Nova and the Nimrod. One of them, I do history of biology, so those are my favorite. Here, one of the interesting ones was they had discovered certain fossil plants and fossil flora from an ancient period, from the Mesozoic and the Paleozoic eras in the southern continents. And they couldn't figure out how they could get to Australia, South America, Africa, in basically the same state of evolutionary development. And the creationists were using that as an argument against Darwin. Darwin was still alive at this time, this 1880s. And so Darwin says there must be a continent in Antarctica. At that time, no one even knew if there was a continent in Antarctica. They knew there were some islands down there, at least some land. They knew there was an ice cap, but they didn't know if it was like the North Pole, where you had basically an ice cap anchored on an archipelago of islands. He says, no, there must be a continental landmass down there. It must have once been warmer, and this flora must have evolved there and then moved north as the global climate changed. And then we then moved north till it was in South America, Africa, Australia, places like that. Joseph Hooker, who was president of the Royal Society, picks that up. And Joseph Hooker had been on Ross's expedition to the Antarctic in the 1840s. And he's still around. And he's on the planning committee for the Discovery expedition. And he pushes it. He meets with the prime minister. He pushes funding for this expedition. And what he wants to do is find this fossil to prove the creationist wrong and to prove this evolutionary theory. So there's one group. Now, Lord Kelvin, the great physicist, was very much involved. He was a former president of the Royal Society, too. He was on the planning committee as well. What he was interested in was terrestrial magnetism. At that time, they really didn't know the magnetic lines. They didn't know where the magnetic South Pole was, and they didn't know the magnetic lines for the Southern Hemisphere. And this was at the height of the British Empire. Britain ruled a quarter of the world's land, including Australia, New Zealand, and South Africa, which were the centers of the empire. They both had recent discoveries in gold, and they were important. So there were all these ships that were traveling in the Roaring 40s and the Furious 50s, and they didn't have good, by then they had to guide by a compass, and they couldn't really know where their compass was pointing because they didn't know the South Polar magnetic fields. And so perfecting this, getting terrestrial magnetism down right, and getting to the South Magnetic Pole and doing readings down in the Great Southern Ocean, deep in the Great Southern Ocean, that was another major effort. Indeed, the ship Discovery was purpose-built for the first expedition, all wood, one of the last wooden ships of this sort ever built, in a time when they were building ships in iron, so they could take magnetic readings on the boat. Then you can just start. And all three expeditions were heavily involved in both looking for fossils, and doing terrestrial magnetism. They also took along one of the first seismographs invented by a member of the Royal Society, funded by Japan of all countries, because they were interested in earthquakes, and they had put the first seismographs in Japan, in California, in Chile, and in Australia. They needed one in the south, and so Scott's expedition ran one for 2 years under the direction of John Milne, who designed it. And there they discovered the Ring of Fire, the so-called Ring of Fire of the volcanic activity that surrounds the Pacific. All these activities, and then they studied the mammals. They discovered the life cycle of the emperor penguins, that it breeds in the winter. They discovered the ocean currents, building on the work of the Challenger, that the cold coming in from Antarctica dips down with an undercurrent that cools basically the Pacific, the Atlantic, and the Indian Ocean. There's an undercurrent flowing from the Arctic and from the Antarctic. In a way, they concluded, when you add all these pieces together, they discovered that there was a continent in Antarctica, a continental landmass. They discovered it was once much warmer that it had life, that it had plants, that it had animals. They discovered the fossils, remains. They discovered that it had gotten colder and that it now was warming again by their study of the glacial patterns and the dry valleys. And they discovered that the air currents from the cold circulate. There's an upper air circulation based on Antarctica, and also an undercurrent in the oceans, so that the Great Southern Ocean, which was pretty much ignored before the Challenger and before the Discovery expeditions, was really the fundamental ocean. And in a way, as they put it, the Indian, the Pacific, and the Atlantic are really bays of the Great Southern Ocean and regulated by the Great Southern Ocean. When you put all these pieces together, they're really discovering for the first time that there is a global ecology, that the entire globe has one ecosystem, one great ecology, and in many ways it's governed from the south, from Antarctica. In that way, before scientists had always focused on the northern hemisphere, they literally turned the world upside down and saw the centrality of Antarctica for the global ecological system. This was the sort of breathtaking scientific work. And in so many ways, what we're still doing today with our enormous investment in Antarctic research is following up on what they began.
So what would you like people who come to this exhibition to take away? What will they learn about Scott that maybe they didn't know before?
I really hope that they will know that Scott's last expedition was much more than just a journey to the South Pole. That story is amazingly gripping and thrilling, but there was so much more going on, and there were so many more people with there on top of the Scott and his polar party. So I really want people to walk away feeling amazed that there was so much work going on, and that they really feel that the scientific work they did had was important and had had an impact. And it was really important at the time. They carried out research in many different fields, and at the time it was the broadest scientific research project that gone to Antarctica. And they really made a great contribution to what was known about Antarctica, which of course not much was known at the time.
What happened to Scott in the end? Where does he... We know that he didn't survive, but what happened after he didn't come back?
So on the 29th of March 1912, he wrote his last diary entry in his tent. And at that stage, they were only about 20 kilometres away from a depot, and they desperately needed food and fuel. So that's really sad. The people back at the hut, the base camp hut, of course, soon realising they must have died. And then when the spring returned, they went out to look for them. So they went out in November in 1912 and luckily found them alongside letters and diaries. And they felt that, you know, the best thing to do would just be to leave them there in the Antarctic wilderness. And they're still there today in the ice, slowly floating towards the sea.
So he's had a legacy which to this day carries on. I mean, there are bases on Antarctica that are permanently manned nowadays. And you've mentioned everything from geography to evolution to weather systems to ecology. Why then is Scott's final mission seen through the light of him being a failed leader?
Largely because the focus is on the race to the pole. That's a great story to tell. I can understand why historians and journalists, commentators love to tell that story. It's what the newspapers picked up then, because this was an era of yellow journalism, of popular presses, of races. There were great, there were car races across the Russia and Siberia. There were car races across North America. There were plane races going on, airplane races. And here, when it turned out that Scott, who had long planned this trip to the pole as part of this scientific expedition, when Amundsen turned on a dime and went that way too, it was too good a story to pass up. It had pathos, it had tragedy, it had triumph, where the science is more complex, it's more subtle. It's the same way people talk about The Apollo moon missions of getting to the moon, and they love to talk about the one that didn't and had that that exciting trip back. Those are stories people like to tell, is more than the intricacies of the scientific research. I'm a historian of science. I was always fascinated by the level and the sophistication of the scientific research being done. But it's really, that's really not a story about Scott, because Scott was simply the captain. The scientists were other people, people like Edgeworth David and Raymond Priestley, Griffith Taylor, the variety of other scientists who went on the trip, James Murray. Their story, I think, is just as exciting, but it doesn't have this adventure. Now, if you focus on the race to the pole, Scott made a lot of poor choices. He had a plan, but he made a lot of poor choices, like in the end taking five people rather than four. Of course, he eschewed dogs and went for man-hauling, while the Amundsen sailed down on his dogs and sailed back and was an expert skier, was an expert dog mushers. The British were not good at running dogs. He made a lot of poor choices on that part of the trip. And when those choices are added together with the misfortune of the colder weather, the slower trip, the fact that he lost half of his horses before he even went, when you add the misfortunes to the poor choices, it becomes a tale of a blundering, and it seems like a backward-looking blundering because of this refusal to use dogs and insistence on man-hauling, which seemed out of date, compared to the tremendous efficiency of Amundsen, who didn't try to do any science, was solely focused on getting the pole, and in a remarkable effort of Scandinavian efficiency, they went down and back in 99 days, and Amundsen gained weight on the trip, where Scott starves to death.
And on that note, I think we'll leave it there. Edward Larson, thank you very much. Edward Larson's book, An Empire of Ice, is published by Yale University Press and is out now. Thanks also to curator Ellen Simonson of the Natural History Museum in London. Scott's last expedition will open on January the 20th, 2012. For more information, head to their website at nhm.ac.uk. The music featured in this podcast is Vaughan Williams' symphony dedicated to Scott, Sinfonia Antarctica, and it was performed by the London Symphony Orchestra. Again, it's available for purchase at many reputable online stores. We also featured original field recordings from Antarctica by Pascal Wise. Check out Pascal's visit to Antarctica on the travel section of The Guardian's website. That's it for this edition of Science Weekly. For all your science news needs, head over to guardian.co.uk/science. But from me, Alok Char, and Science Weekly producer Jason Phipps, it's goodbye.
The Guardian has partnered with audible.co.uk to offer listeners a free audiobook when you sign up for a one-month, no-commitment trial of the Audible service. Audible has over 50,000 audiobook titles available to download. Go to guardian.co.uk/audible for further details.
For more great downloads, go to guardian.co.uk/audio.